Hello and welcome back to another episode of Open Floor. I'm Andrew Sharp, and on the other line, our official photographer, Ben Golliver. What's up, man?
Hey, Andrew. I'm pretty good. That first round of Durant versus Westbrook didn't really go, I think, like most people wanted it to. I'm pretty confident it didn't go the way that you wanted it to. Westbrook's photography vest was an incredible mind game that just completely did not work.
Yeah, I think we were all kind of hoping for like the Super Bowl of anger last night, and it just didn't quite come together. So today we'll talk about John Wall and the Wizards. We're going to talk a little Cavs. I'm going to force you to talk about DeMar DeRozan. But let's start with, I mean, I feel like this was the most anticipated game of the season, certainly thus far. But I mean, we've all been waiting for it for a few months. We should start with the vest. What do you think of the vest?
I loved the people who said it wasn't a shot at Durant. Those people are my favorite idiots. I mean, give me a break. Of course it was a shot at Durant. Trying to get under his skin a little bit, trying to get into his head before the big meeting. I think even, you know, more important than the vest, though, was just the circumstances. I mean, should we get a little bit angry about the back-to-back? I mean, Oklahoma City, after some pretty easy warm-up games this season, has to go to the Clippers, who have been playing well in L.A., they grind out a win there, and then they have to fly up immediately to deal with the Warriors in Oakland. I mean, that doesn't seem great from a scheduling standpoint.
Thank you for bringing that up. I texted you about this on, I think, like Tuesday. I was so upset when I realized that the Thunder had to play the night before. Like, I don't understand how someone at the NBA could get that wrong. Like, someone needs to get fired over this, because, like, all we cared about was this game.
Easy.
And, like, I mean, no, it's like all we cared about was this game. And I just feel like putting the Thunder at a disadvantage after, I mean, they already lost Durant. Like, come on.
Well, here's the thing, too. Like, here's how bad it was. After that Clippers game, Victor Oladipo goes over to Westbrook and he's like, hey, man, what do we do after back to backs? And Westbrook's like, oh, we just watch film in the morning. Don't worry about it. Like, it's so early in the season, and these guys are, you know, so young and thrown together in their infancy of the post-Durant era that key members of the team don't even know whether they have shoot around the morning of a back-to-back. And you're going to throw them into that snake pit, which is Oracle Arena. I mean, that's not great.
Yeah,
but at the same time, we're really looking forward to Durant's return to Oklahoma City, though. I think that game is a higher profile, and I'm actually willing to sacrifice this one just a little bit if we can preserve that one for maximum viewing later in the season.
I guess so. If anything, the Warriors should have been on a back-to-back to try and level the playing field, to heighten the drama a little bit. Yeah, I mean, the vest thing was a good microcosm of the game itself, because I saw that on Twitter at like 9:45 East Coast time and was really excited. I was like, here we go. Like, Russ is still pissed. He's still taking shots at KD. This is going to be awesome. And then about halfway through the second quarter, it started to get out of hand. And I was like, man, I really wish he hadn't worn that vest. This is all just really sad. Russ had put a lot of time and energy into this game, and it's just like not even, it's just sad.
Well, I think at this point, though, Westbrook's a martyr. So it doesn't really matter if the strategy works or not. It's all about like the psychosis behind the strategy, right? Like, the people who are rooting for Westbrook in this battle versus the evil empire of Durant are just excited to have a hero, and he is playing that role so perfectly. I mean, after the game against the Clippers, he would refuse to answer multiple questions about Durant, wouldn't say Durant's name, wouldn't even really refer to him specifically. He wanted to take any question that was about only Durant and kind of make it a question about the Warriors in general. I noticed during his post-game interview, after the Warriors loss, he did the same thing. I mean, this guy, I don't even think hates is the right word. I think he just despises Kevin Durant at this point. And frankly, I don't know if Kevin Durant completely understands the level of acrimony that's there, because he spent like 4 days before this game trying to extend olive branches only for Westbrook to basically torch all of them.
Yeah, acrimony is a good word for what's happening here. Because yeah, it's beyond anger. But can I say one thing that I liked about last night is Kevin Durant is pissed off too, and he was going
finally
all in on the court. I mean, off the court, he's mostly said the right things, but you could tell last night that he had cranked it up a notch against them. And angry Kevin Durant is a lot of fun to watch. I think that was maybe the takeaway last night, is that pissed off Durant is maybe more fun than pissed off Russ.
Well, you know that old line about you weren't with me shooting in the gym?
Yeah.
I really think Kevin Durant dedicated that to Jeremy Grant after that dunk. Because, you know, when the Thunder, Westbrook, Cantor, Steven Adams, these guys are going through this like serious identity crisis over the summer, trying to move on from Durant. They had just been through this playoff battle, this choke job in Oklahoma City that's going to kind of stay with that franchise forever. Durant's going through all of the emotions, right? These guys are neck deep in this personal drama. And you've got a guy like Jeremy Grant who basically entered the season just hoping he was going to win 12 games with the Sixers, right? Completely anonymous, can't even really crack their rotation. And he's the one who steps to Durant. And at that moment, you could just kind of tell KD was like, wait a minute, I'm by far the best player on this court. I don't even know who Jeremy Grant is or why he's trying to talk to me. Why is he even on this team? And it seemed like that's really when he kind of woke up. And Steve Kerr said that. And I thought it was a pretty remarkable run right after that dunk. And it really helped that Westbrook was on the bench. And that was kind of the knock on Oklahoma City, right? They didn't have enough depth. They were going to be overwhelmed by Golden State's talent. And as soon as Westbrook went off the court at the worst possible time following that dunk, the floodgates opened so quickly.
Yeah. I mean, credit Jerry and Grant, though. That was an awesome dunk. Like, I was standing up in my living room after that play and was like, holy shit, OKC is just going to, like, run through these guys. And then I think it was a wake-up call for everyone who was cheering for the Thunder, and especially for Jerry and Grant, that he is on a different level at this point. Because I mean,
saying that Jeremy Grant's dunk was great is like saying a BMX biker's wipeout was amazing. Like, yes, he got like the three full turns in before completely like splattered his body parts all across the dirt track. But yeah, that was
I don't think he's played in very many games where teams are really paying attention and would actually take that personally. Like if Jeremy Grant did that on the Sixers, I don't think KD would even like realize it, because he'd just be sort of like going half speed the entire game. But he was locked in last night, and then Jeremy Grant just sort of took it to a whole other level.
Yeah, I think he actually did that in Las Vegas Summer League, and I'm sure you and I were really excited about it in a completely empty gym that everybody else immediately forgot about that amazing highlight like 15 minutes later.
Can we talk about another guy who was pretty locked in early on? What about the Steve Kerr outburst?
Well, he's really good at that. He feigns absolute homicidal outrage better than almost any coach in the NBA.
It was amazing.
Mike Ogun, also, did you know that Mike Brown can run a 4.5 40? Because I had no idea. I mean, he was sprinting after Steve Kerr to get out, make sure he didn't get ejected. But yeah, I feel like that's one of Kerr's deep bag of tricks.
I guess so. The other reaction I had, though, that and the time that he split the whiteboard with his bare hands in the finals, I think, was that last year?
I'm not sure, but he's done that a couple times.
Yeah, well, that was the angriest I'd ever seen Steve Kerr. And especially last night, I was like, it's pretty early in the season. It's the first quarter. I'm not sure where this is coming from. But the other thing was watching him walk. And like, I guess he was half running, but he just looks wobbly when he walks down the sidelines, and it made me feel bad for him. Like, the back surgery thing is a real thing for Kerr.
Yeah, I think his personality has changed a little bit since he got there too. And I do too. You know, and personally, I do think a little bit of, or at least maybe even a big part of it, it's the health issue. I mean, he just doesn't seem quite as patient. I mean, he was nice and super duper patient when he first got there, and real kind of like hands off and like trending towards Luke Walton vibes. And now he's kind of trending towards like Greg Popovich, like screamer vibes at times. And hey, you know, if your body's not right, I can understand why that would happen. But I thought in this case, it really was a tactical move. I mean, they're down 10 in the first quarter. Oklahoma City's kind of taking it to them a little bit. Adams is really shaking them up inside, and I'm sure he was frustrated to see that. Westbrook was starting to get loose a little bit, and I think he was just trying to wake his guys up, because they have been kind of going through these little stretches where it hasn't been maximum focus and maximum energy. And when they do turn it on, especially defensively, they can be really, really good. And it's obvious when they turn it on. And I think the combination of Kerr's outburst plus Jeremy Grant's dunk plus Durant's response and then Westbrook going to the bench, it was like, well, that played out pretty much perfectly from a chess standpoint for the Warriors.
Can I add one other factor? Enes Kanter came on the court at the end of the first quarter, and they could not guard a single person on the Warriors. As soon as he came on the court, it went from like, wow, this is back and forth, to like, nope, OKC does not have a shot in this game.
Yeah, once they were exchanging trash talk, Kanter and Durant, I was just envisioning Kanter being like, yeah, but you're a traitor, and Durant being, yeah, but your defensive real plus minus is absolutely terrible. Like, I could just see him going to the deep well of like Statner jokes as they were exchanging trash talk. Don't know if that actually happened.
I don't think that's what was said. But that moment when,
let me dream,
when Kanter was going back and forth with him, that was another moment where I was just kind of bummed about the way that this is all worked out. You know what I mean? Because the rest of the bench, they didn't seem like they were in like a trash talking place with Durant. They were just sort of like, Steven Adams went and was like, stop talking to him. And I don't know, man, it just, all of last night bummed me out because it shouldn't have worked out this way.
I love Steven Adams interjecting. It reminded me of like my mom, if I get mad at like a customer service representative, you know, and like she, for whatever reason, she's in the room with me and it's like, please tone it down, chill out. Like, don't, you know, don't lose it. Cause I feel like Steven Adams knew the score at that point. Like the more they pushed Durant, you know, the more it escalated, the worse it was going to get for the Thunder. And I actually thought by the time it was like the late third, early fourth, when that game was basically into like, you know, garbage time, and they just kept Durant in the game kind of mercilessly, by the way, that's another Steve Kerr thing that he did there, is like leave Durant in probably 5 or 6 minutes too long just to let him get his numbers up. But didn't it kind of have like a training camp vibe in the fourth quarter where it was like Durant, like in the first day of like Oklahoma City training camp, being like, hey, Joffrey, like Alex Sabrina's like, welcome to the NBA, welcome to the Thunder. Like, this is my team and I'm going to completely dominate you for the next 10 minutes so that you know it.
Yeah,
that's kind of how it felt to me. You know, it was like the ones going versus the twos, and it was maybe cathartic for KD a little bit.
I definitely think it was cathartic for him. And again, it was cool to see that there's a lot of emotion on his side too, and he has been taking this personally. He didn't shake hands with any of the Thunder after the game. And you know,
the Thunder didn't shake hands with him.
I don't know, man.
He was standing like kind of wandering awkwardly, like feeling it out, and there was like literally nothing coming back from them as they're like storming off the court. So he put the towel on his head and, you know, just kind of retreated to the comfort of his David Aldridge interview. I don't blame him, but yeah. I think that was a Thunder driven lack of communication.
I loved KD's quote after the game. What did he play? 3 minutes? I'm sure he'll have something to say on Twitter. That is Enes Kanter has taken some L's over the years between last night and I think it was it Trevor Booker who called him out a few years ago?
Oh, yeah. The Jazz hate him, and the Jazz fans still hate him. It's almost to like Raymond Felton in Portland levels with their feelings towards him. But that's how you kind of hope these things go, right? When you get that close as teammates, and I'm sure Durant stood up for Kanter for what, like a year straight? You know, at some point when the guy doesn't play any defense, when, you know, basically he's got completely empty stats. And let's not forget, like not that long ago, KD was campaigning for this guy to be the sixth man of the year.
Yeah.
And now he's coming back with like the ultra low digs. I mean,
like, I don't even know you.
Yeah. It flipped quick.
Yeah. That's why I feel okay though, not liking Enes Kanter, because like, The way his Jazz teammates reacted when he left says a lot about how he's seen around the league. So what are the big takeaways here, though, for last night?
Well, I think the big takeaway, and this is probably a take that nobody else has, but I consider the Thunder winners. They had to go on a back-to-back road situation against contenders, and they split. You know, that's what a really good team does. And I thought it was kind of an ugly game against the Clippers. Russ was able to kind of pull it out late. I thought the Clippers defense showed up, but their offense didn't show up. Chris just kind of looked a little out of sorts in that game. I'm not sure exactly what was going on there. Just chalk it up to a bad game. But if you're the Thunder and you're trying to really build momentum and prove to teams like, hey, we should still be in the mix to try to win the Northwest, we should still be, you know, potentially a home court team, which I'm sure is what they're hoping for, you know, you get a split and you take it. I mean, that's not bad at all. And I realize that emotionally, that's, you know, kind of a moral victory.
Yeah.
But that would be my message if I was Billy Donovan.
No, I actually think that's a really good point, because I think coming into it, my worry when I texted you on Tuesday complaining about the schedule, my worry was that they were going to lose at the Clippers and be spent coming into Thursday night and then get their asses kicked in Golden State. And it was going to turn into just like a really dark week. But yeah, I mean, I think they surprised everybody in LA. And, you know, last night, like, there's only so much there. Golden State is a bad matchup for them, but their season is already, I think, more successful than people would have expected.
I think another takeaway from this is just sort of like philosophically, like the Warriors have to win, right? And if you're the Thunder, despite the ugly loss and the way it went down and how painful it was to, you know, basically be done in by your former teammate who you probably view as a traitor, did it really matter that much for them? I mean, does it change our perception of them as a team or their outlook or anything? I mean, it really feels to me like people are now supporting the Thunder because of what Westbrook sort of represents as this sort of, you know, this alternative to Durant, as opposed to what's actually happening on the court, right? Like, whether they win or lose is almost secondary to the way that they're carrying themselves and this sort of, you know, personality, this cult of personality that he's created. Or maybe I'm reading too much into it. That's just kind of how I felt. Like, I think people, a good number of NBA fans saw Westbrook wear that photographer's vest and was like, well, he already won the night. It's over. It doesn't even matter what happens on the court.
I mean, Russ is great. And I understand people who kind of like roll their eyes at this point, but I'm not sick of it because he's just...
Oh, definitely not.
Yeah, and it's not necessarily an act. Like, he really is this dude. He's not a character that people have created. And I would say the only other thing that I was thinking as that game unfolded is that the Warriors are a whole lot more interesting when they look vulnerable. I think the Warriors of the first few days were a lot more fun to watch and think about than the Warriors who are just going to blow teams off the court and end games by like halfway through the second quarter.
No, I feel you. I mean, as soon as Steph Curry went to that behind-the-back left-handed pass in transition and Durant just steps into the play perfectly, knocks down the three-pointer,
yeah,
you start to think like, well, basically only LeBron can stop this.
Right. You know? There are times when it honestly looks like an all-star team out there where they're not only like better than everybody else, but they're also kind of just screwing around and doing whatever they want. And that's when you're like, okay, well, I don't know. I mean, why even play these games? And I get the people who are like, it's a spectacle of great basketball and great players. But personally, I think it would have been cooler to watch KD go for 40 against the Thunder on a different team.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I mean, I still look at it like this is... Number one, it's just purely entertaining. I mean, it was really fun to see not only them start to gel and click a little bit, but them really ratchet up the defensive intensity. And then also, it's fun to see KD comfortable. And I think they've done the best thing the Warriors have done so far this season is get him into a groove. I think he's been just basically, you know, acclimated very, very well. Yes, there's been some adjustments that need to happen around him.
That's why he needed to leave Oklahoma City. Like, wherever he went, he was going to get more shots and a chance to get into more of a rhythm than he ever did with Russ. And so I don't blame him for leaving, because from a basketball standpoint, like, this version of Durant is what we've wanted for years.
Yeah, and it happened quick, and it's been really fun to watch. So that's why I'm not really looking back or second-guessing his decision at this point. I've pretty much moved past it and accepted it, but that's sort of what we all thought on July 5th once we started to think like, oh, what's that first game against the Thunder going to go like? I mean, this was sort of what we expected, right? I mean, deeper, more talented team smoking them off the court.
Well, you took two teams that went seven games and you took the best player from one of those teams and just gave them to the other team. Like, yeah, it's not going to be that close.
That's why I'm saying that the Westbrook fans and the Thunder fans probably don't even care. I mean, they probably view yesterday as a victory because they stood up to Durant in some philosophical way, and that's great. And they're going to get a shot at them in Oklahoma City. And that game, we know for sure, the first game back in Oklahoma City is not going to go down like the one last night. There is no way that they're going to go down that easily.
It'll be interesting. I don't know. I mean, if KD plays like that, sorry, like there's nothing anybody can do. And that's true for whoever the Warriors play against this year. It's like if Durant is going to be on that level, it's just, I mean, everybody else can give up. The other thing I would say about Durant is that he is the key for them defensively, because if he's going to be in the passing lanes like that and be protecting the rim a little bit the way he was last night, then the defense can work.
I think against most matchups, yeah. I think Cleveland still, I mean, they have personnel that can really pound the glass. And so even if he's, you know, contesting shots, blocking shots, I mean, a guy like Tristan Thompson,
that's true, yeah.
Being able to get in there for second chance points and really pound the paint, I mean, that is a pretty effective counter to that small look from Golden State. If I'm Kerr, the only thing that I'm really worried about from that game was how bad Zaza was getting killed early. But they did adjust out of that, and everything else looked pretty good. But I think this is really all setting up. I mean, the table is really being set for a very, very, very intriguing third round of Cavs versus Warriors. I mean, I know it's a long ways away, but like the Cavs have been the best story that nobody's talking about because they've been unreal the first week of the season.
Hold on. I have two more thoughts from Warriors Thunder. KG and Rashid, did you watch them after the game?
I couldn't allow myself to do it. I just kind of left it on mute and figured if they said anything completely outrageous, Twitter would go nuts about it. But nah, I was trying to write, and I was worried that if I did listen for a second, it was going to be over and I was going to be sucked in for the rest of my life.
They are so good. I think Rashid was like a temporary thing last night, but I really hope they bring him back permanently, or maybe bring him back for the playoffs, because I just love both of those dudes so much. They were pretty funny the entire night. I would pay a lot of money to have like a live feed of those guys watching games, like an alternate version of League Pass where we watch Garnett and Rashid watch League Pass. Would be, I'd pay like probably $400 for that.
Yeah, it's funny because remember when people used to love Chris Webber a commentator a few years ago? That soured pretty quickly. I mean, it seems like people have gone pretty anti-Weber pretty hard. I wonder if we could have just subbed those two guys in the Weber role.
C-Web, I want to like him, but he just says like at least once per quarter, he says things that make me that jolt me awake, because I don't really even pay attention to announcers that much. But he says things that are just crazy. Like during the Knicks game, the Knicks-Cavs on opening night, he was all over D. Rose like the entire game, saying like, Knicks fans, get excited for this. And I was just like, C-Web, like, do you know any Knicks fans? Like, I don't know a single Knicks fan who's excited for Derrick Rose.
Yeah, I think he predicted the Warriors could score 170 points in a game, which I'm not sure that's going to happen.
I mean, we're all rooting for him, but they're too many head-scratching lines.
No, the point was just imagine Rashid in that role, and I think it's a big upgrade.
Well, Rashid, you'd probably run into some FCC issues if he were on a live mic the entire night, although they did have a cuss button on TNT last night.
Oh, geez.
TNT just does such a good job with the NBA. Those guys get it. They get why people love basketball.
Yeah, I think that they don't get enough credit for how much they've helped build this fan base of diehards. You know, the people who are on League Pass constantly on Twitter all night, every night. I mean, I think that TNT's main cast of characters and their passion and their ability to communicate about basketball has really, really helped the retention efforts of the league. You know, I mean, there's been ups and downs over the last 10, 15 years in terms of star power on the court, but those guys have been really, really consistent. And, you know, I look forward to it every chance I get. And I know there's a lot of people out there who do that. That was not a very scorching hot take. That was just kind of a nice thing to say, but
yeah.
I'll say it.
Yeah.
They do deserve credit. They're really good. And I think the guys like, you know, on NBA TV, like the starters, same thing. Those guys are amazing.
Yeah. No hot takes, just like keep doing your thing. TNT. It's awesome. And the starters. Let's talk Cavs though. So I'm pretty shocked by how good they look early on.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Nobody is talking about them either, which really feels unfair. I mean, everyone's going to like bend over backwards because of, you know, LeBron at an Indians game. Well, let's talk about LeBron at the Cavs games. He's been great. And like J.R. Smith is hitting every shot, it seems like. Ball movement's been unbelievable. Tristan Thompson picked up where he left off these last couple of playoff trips. They're clicking. Body language is incredible. Everybody's happy for each other. I think we got to start throwing Ty Lue into this Coach of the Year conversation based on where they are now compared to where they are previous years. I actually saw Brad Stevens kind of gave the Cavaliers credit before the game last night, saying it was the best Cavs team he'd seen in November since he's been in the NBA. And I totally agree with that in terms of, you know, how far along they are.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess the big question remains, like, do they have enough talent? Can they match up defensively with Golden State stars if those guys are really clicking? But I don't know where you pick any nits with what they've done in the first, you know, 2 weeks of the season. I mean, it's basically been perfect.
You know, so there's a Cavs writer, Conrad Kazmarek. Do you know him?
Of course.
Yeah. Well, so he tweeted last night, the Cavs still haven't lost a game since Klay Thompson told LeBron it was a man's league.
Oof.
Which I love. And, you know, LeBron is not messing around. I think he's definitely trying to average a triple-double and is in a good spot where he doesn't have to, like, empty the tank every night, but is on cruise control and is still really, really effective.
The balance offensively between him and Kyrie looks pretty good, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's like they figured it out. And the other thing with them is, people talk about this, it's hard to sort of prove anything one way or another, but I think winning a title really does help guys hit like a whole different level of confidence. And you're seeing it definitely with Kyrie, and I also think you're seeing it with Love and maybe even JR. Like, they're just really comfortable, have nothing to prove, and are just sort of doing their thing.
Well, I think it's almost like a quality of life issue. I mean, go back to last year. LeBron is answering question after question from a gigantic media horde about, you know, the team, blah.
Oh, yeah.
Are people happy?
The last 2 years, there was just nonstop drama with them. It was like a never-ending soap opera.
So you got to figure at some point LeBron's waking up at like 6 o'clock in the morning with a big sigh like, okay, here we go again, right? And
yeah,
all of that is now gone. So from a quality of life perspective, all he's got to do is go out there. He's clearly the best player in the NBA still, all-around player. He's got teammates that he finally trusts. He's got a coach who he clearly likes. They don't have any obvious drama. They paid JR, so that sideshow is taken care of. Everybody seems like they came into camp in shape and pretty motivated to make a title run. I mean, what more does a person, you know, of LeBron's talent and of his age and at this point of his career really want? I mean, he's basically got it all, and he's got the validation and the knowledge that he doesn't have to get pestered by these daily questions about, you know, his legacy and so on and so forth. So, I mean, I think that he's the biggest winner here because, you know, free LeBron, you know, unburdened LeBron is a very, very scary thing.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. The drama has been replaced by group outings to, like, Indians games. And when LeBron's teams, when things are good, look more fun than any other team in basketball.
I mean, I thought LeBron basically wanted to just dispose of Blatt for, like, 18 straight months. And then last month, the only time I've seen him less than ecstatic was when he was put on the Jumbotron and he was drinking a beer and he didn't want to be, like, a bad influence on kids.
I didn't see
that. That was, like,
that.
The only time I've seen him unhappy. Yeah. No, he was like, come on, guys, what are you doing? He's like pointing to his head like, come on, use your head. I'm drinking a beer here. Don't put me on the screen.
So what about the other thing I like is that he did the 3-1 lead thing at his Halloween party. He had the 3-1 lead cookies, and obviously things did not go well for the Indians from there. But LeBron is bulletproof. I haven't even heard anyone criticize him for that.
Well, do you really think he put the frosting on the cookies? I mean, come on.
Well, I think those cookies would not have been there if they had not been cleared by LeBron.
Wow. So his quality control extends all the way to the icing on the cookies.
Hold up. You don't think he was involved in any of that?
I mean, I think he probably hired somebody, or, you know, he kind of delegated it to someone and said, yeah, let's make this good. And, you know, that person was probably a jazzed up Cavs fan and went all out and, you know, one picture and it was too late. You know, I don't know. I mean, do you really think he was pushing that hard? He doesn't seem that petty, does he?
I would be surprised if that stuff got circulated on social media and LeBron didn't know about it or wasn't asked about it. I don't know, man.
Well, your theory is more fun, so let's go with it.
I kind of wish if the roles had been reversed. Can you imagine if the Warriors were talking trash like that?
Yeah, I can, because they did it in the middle of the finals and then blew up on them. They lost three straight, and that's why we're here.
Yeah, great point. Yeah. So what else is going on from this week?
Well, you were flipping out about DeRozan, I thought.
I absolutely was. Do you want to talk DeRozan?
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, so I think you owe me... No, you don't owe me an apology. You owe DeMar DeRozan an apology.
Come on.
You owe DeMar DeRozan an apology. I was sitting there Wednesday night at the Wizards game, and he just... He won the game by himself. He abused almost anyone the Wizards put in front of him, got whatever he wanted. The jumper, the mid-range jumper, is better than I've ever seen it. He's working in the post. I mean, look, two podcasts ago, you asked me about this, and I said, I don't have passionate opinions about DeMar DeRozan, but he's really good, and he's so much better than he was 2 years ago. When, you know, I think they had a decent regular season and then kind of tailed off and got their asses kicked by the Wizards. And he's just a completely different player.
Okay, he's playing the best basketball of his career. Do you expect him to continue to hit 60% of his mid-range jumpers? Because that's what this boils down to. Like, if you firmly believe that over the course of an 82-game season, he is going to continue to shoot 60% from the mid-range, especially when he plays teams unlike the Wizards who have a clue on defense and compete hard for 48 minutes, then, yeah, he's this incredible player who can't be stopped. Unfortunately, I don't think that's going to happen. I think we're going to get what's called regression to the mean. And he's going to still be playing the best basketball of his career, which is certainly better than it was 2 years ago. But it's not quite as good as Toronto and Canada and everyone would have you believe. Yes, he's very physical. He can pound undersized and young defenders, no question about it. He's very skilled at getting to the free throw line. And he's taken steps to try to fill out his game in certain ways. He's doing a little bit better, you know, when he draws the extra defender to try to find an open teammate for the driving kick shot. He's made some improvements there. All around defensive impact, all around offensive game, no 3-point shot. Is that going to really hold up over the course of a postseason? I mean, where does it end, I guess, is my question with him.
I'm going to look it up right now. I think he's averaging like 35 a game right now. So yeah,
but okay, look, he shot the only good defense he's played is Cleveland, and he shot his typical 42% from the field against them, and that was a loss. So right. I mean, he's beating up on these weak sister teams like the Wizards. I hate to call you guys that, but it's true. And so I mean, I don't know. I think he's had a great first week. It's the best I've seen him play in a long time, but the amount of excitement that he's generated, I think, is a little bit disproportionate to the overall impact and the staying power of his play. In other words,
yeah, you know, no, look, he's not going to average 35 I'm short a game on DeRozan. All year. He's at 36.3 is where he is now.
Yeah, not even close. I mean, give me a break. That's going to fall off considerably. And I think the real story with the Raptors to me is like, what's going on with Kyle Lowry? Like, this is supposed to be a contract year, and this guy really up and down through the first, you know, week and a half of the season hasn't looked like career year Kyle Lowry we saw last year. So that's a little strange because, I mean, clearly DeRozan came in motivated, in shape, probably helped that he was on the Olympic team so that, you know, he was kind of staying around basketball but not actually playing very many minutes for them, so he didn't tire himself out. But, yeah, no, to me, I think, you know, Kyle Lowry is the bigger story. I mean, he's going to have to turn it on if they want to be as good as they were last year.
Yeah, I'm not too worried about Kyle Lowry. He's someone who just, I think, if you're expecting him to go out and get 25 a night, that's not going to happen. But if he's solidly at like 18-7 and DeRozan is averaging 28 a game, I think 28 a game is realistic for DeRozan right now, just because the way he works in the post and the way he gets to the line is really tough to stop, and it gives them like a great half court option, which is what that's sort of like what any NBA team is looking for from a star, is a guy who you can pass it to and get a bucket from in the half court.
They force feed him for sure, and that's how they should. I mean, yeah, he is very physical, and he can really dominate his matchups one-on-one.
So, and hold on, let me ask you,
historically,
though.
Yeah.
How often are Raptors fans, like, in your mentions?
I don't know. I don't read my mentions, so I couldn't tell you. But
I never believe it when someone tells me they don't read their mentions.
No,
but
I think
you might be the exception.
I 100% don't. I'm under 28 points per game for him on the season, and I will bet that.
Okay. I'm not prepared to put money on it because I don't feel that strongly about DeRozan, but I did watch him just tear through the Wizards the other night and was like, whoa, this is a different version of the player that I've been ignoring for the last 5 years.
No, there's no question he's made demonstrable progress in his game, but it really comes down to that jumper, and he's having the best shooting week of his life. And we just saw during the playoffs multiple series where their offense and his game goes on life support once he's playing against good defenders who are scheming for him, and every shot is a turnaround from 18 feet with a hand in his face. Like, those are just not shots you can hit at the rate that he's hitting them right now. And, you know, it's a pretty easy bet to expect him to kind of fall off. That's not a very hard one to make.
So you refuse to apologize, is what you're saying.
I don't think I have anything to apologize for.
What
am I apologizing for?
Fine. Stick to your guns. Do you want to talk about...
No, here, do it this way. This is their big argument, is that there's guys at his position, you know, that we ranked better than him on our top 100. But, like, look at it. Like, would you rather have Klay Thompson or DeMar DeRozan?
Definitely Klay. But there are also, I mean, I think... Okay. Wasn't would Jay you, Crowder ahead
have,
of him?
Would you rather have Paul George... Or DeMar DeRozan.
Obviously, yeah. Well, we don't have to go through the top 10 or top 15.
Would you rather have Jimmy Butler or DeMar DeRozan?
Probably Jimmy Butler. DeRozan's
okay.
defense.
So,
look.
So why am I apologizing? That's my point. Like, what's the apology here?
I don't know.
I said a bunch of players who are better than DeMar DeRozan are better than DeMar DeRozan, and you're agreeing with me on every single one. Where's this going?
I need to look at the list again. What about the other drama this week for you, with you?
Yeah, so this is just a soapbox issue, but so I tweeted out a stat about Evan Turner's on-off numbers, or, you know, basically the Blazers plus minus with him on the court and with him off the court, and apparently that started some sort of a back and forth between Jared Solinger and Evan Turner, and I had no intention really of that happening, but whatever. My real takeaway from this whole incident is that basically, you know how people say, like, retweets are not endorsements in their Twitter profiles?
Uh-huh.
I think that, like, basic statistics that get tweeted out are not character assassinations, right? Like, it's just a piece of information to consider. Now, obviously, Evan Turner, big offseason signing. The Blazers are clearly having trouble working him into their second unit.
Yeah.
He thought he was going to start when he signed. He wound up not starting. There's some stylistic issues that they've got to work out to kind of make it work and take their offense to the next level. Portland started 2-3, so it's a little bit frustrating. You know, they lost a game the other night to Phoenix, not a very good team. They're working through some things, right?
Uh-huh.
If you just tweet a basic statistic that says, hey, through four games, here's where it stands, that doesn't mean that he's a terrible person or that it's never going to work out or that his signing was a mistake or whatever. And anyone who has that reaction, it says more about the person who's having the reaction than it says about the actual stat itself, if that makes sense. It's just a piece of information.
Right.
That's all.
So that's it? That's your soapbox take?
No, that's really all I wanted to say, because I think that people look at it and they think, okay, you're putting up this piece of information. Obviously, you have like an axe to grind, or you're trying to reach conclusions after a week into the season that I don't think I definitely was not intending to reach those conclusions.
Yeah.
It was just pretty obvious. I mean, he had, at the time I put that stat up, he had a bottom five plus minus in the NBA. He had the worst plus minus of any player on a team that had won more than one game. So we're taking out guys like Serge Ibaka and so forth.
Totally.
I mean, it was just, you know, and it was coming off of a really ugly loss to the Warriors, where that second unit just got crushed and it wasn't working. So, you know, I just think, chill on the like hyper partisan reactions to a statistic that gets tweeted out.
Okay.
That's my message to Twitter.
All right. Good thought. My two reactions would be, Anyone who listens to this pod and doesn't follow you on Twitter really should, because I'm a huge fan of your like deep cut stats that pop up out of nowhere, like the Evan Turner plus minus, because there's nothing too granular for you. You'll throw out all kinds of random juxtapositions, and the videos that you cut. How do you even do that? Is that like a program?
That's a trade secret. I'm not gonna reveal my I'm not gonna reveal my abilities. But yeah, thank you for plugging my Twitter account at Ben Golliver, BenGolliver.
You should plug yours too. Because I don't even think you tweet regular tweets. You only tweet stats, articles, and like 45-second videos from TNT broadcasts.
I'm kind of over Twitter. We could totally derail this conversation, but. I'm gonna sound like the old guy. Twitter was way better in like 2011.
Yeah,
I think we can all agree on that.
We can all agree that 2010 Kevin Durant Twitter was when Twitter peaked, and it's been downhill ever since. I want to talk about John Wall at the end, because I talked to him this week, but let me just quickly, I have Googled the top 100 to consult your list. I would definitely rather have DeMar DeRozan than number 27, Gordon Hayward. I would rather have him.
Definitely not.
Rather have him than Rudy Gobert.
Nope.
I would rather have him than, let's see, who else? Dwight Howard. I don't know. There are definitely some names in the 20s.
Okay, but you're picking guys who play different positions. So I'm saying take the guys who play the position. So you've got like the one that people might argue would be Chris Middleton. Chris, that's tough because he's out injured, but I would still rather have Chris Middleton than DeMar DeRozan. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. It really depends on which version of DeRozan we're talking about, because if he's averaging 28 a game this year and keeps this going for another few months, then it's a very different conversation. That's all I'm saying, is that he's in a different zone than he ever had been before. So I'm not even hating on your rankings.
But I put it to you directly. I said, do you want to bet on him averaging 28 points a game? And you punted. So I think that speaks to my
Raptors apathy. Okay. That's not about how much faith I do or don't have, but so the other side of that game Wednesday night was the Wizards. And earlier in the day, I had run an interview with John Wall where he was saying he doesn't get a lot of respect, or he doesn't get enough respect around the league. Later that day, people ran with it on ESPN. I think it was on the Rachel Nichols show, The Jump. And everybody was basically like, well, look, you don't get respect because you don't win. That's the way it is. If you want respect, like, go win. And I just feel like it's more complicated than that. So where do you stand with Wall?
I mean, I've been a big Wall guy since high school. I think I saw him the first time in his junior year of high school.
Me too.
I mean, unbelievable prospect. I think that there's definitely room. Like, I expected his game to grow more over the last, whatever, 8 or 9 years since the first time I saw him than it has. I think that ultimately personality of a point guard does go a long way to kind of influencing the direction and the success of an organization. I think that at his peak, he didn't get enough credit. The timing of the injury during the playoffs a couple of years ago was horrible, because I think that had that not happened, he would have, you know, ascended to a different level in terms of general perception and fame. But this is a guy who can't even really get a shoe deal. So, you know, something's wrong.
Yeah, I agree. I'm of two minds. I mean, on the one hand, you look at him versus someone like Damian Lillard, or early in the first week, they played the Grizzlies. And the difference between what Marc Gasol provides for the Grizzlies, just in terms of stability and setting the tone for everybody else, and John Wall, like, I don't think he's that type of leader. So I get where some people might criticize him a little bit. But the flip side is, he does not have any help in DC, and hasn't for a few years. And I just don't think it's fair to say, well, like, the organization is a mess around you, but you should be making the second round of the playoffs if you want people to be taking you seriously.
Yeah, I mean, I think that argument would be easier to make if he had shown like major progress in refining the rough edges of his game. And I think he's made progress. He's definitely a better player now than he was a couple of years ago.
Right.
But there's so many times over the course of a Wizards game where he takes a shot that I just think that doesn't need to be in his diet. You know, if he was a disciplined player, he would have a completely different approach to where he's taking shots from and how he's attacking. And I think athletically, he's on, you know, a Westbrook type level. But when you look at the impact of his athleticism on any given game, like the total impact, there's really no comparison. You know, I think that he could do a better job play to play on both ends, bringing it basically. And I think at times he does, and the results are sensational. And I think at other times he falls into, you know, bad habits. And I think that that is reinforced by kind of a tough organization around him. Like, as you pointed out, the fan base doesn't really cheer for them. They don't really fill that building up.
Yeah.
His teammates, you know, have kind of had some weird, you know, personality issues. But I'm not sure he totally understands sometimes that, like, you know, he speaks his mind very openly, right?
Right.
But when you make comments about contracts and things like that, I'm not sure he understands the impact that has on their overall culture and their overall, you know, just kind of chemistry, or however you want to put it. I mean, it's just not something you should talk about if you're the leader, because then everybody's now concerned with it. You know, everybody's now thinking about it. And so I think, you know, those kinds of things, he'd probably be better off. The team would probably be more successful and happier if those comments kind of had never been made.
Right.
But I do agree that, like, the roster as currently constructed is not very good. They have not put it together like I was kind of hoping they would. And, you know, it's going to be a real mark on his reputation if they continue to be like one of the worst teams in the Eastern Conference during his prime. I mean, he is going to have to own that at some point.
It's tough. You mentioned the Westbrook comparison, and there, I just feel like a lot of people around the league don't really understand Wall's game. And again, this honestly is not me being like a Wizards homer. I liked Wall coming into Kentucky and wrote about him at Kentucky, and then he just happened to end up in DC. And I feel like the Wizards, there are too many nights where they ask him to be Westbrook, and that version of him, like, he's a poor man's Russell Westbrook, and that's not the best way to use him. And I think there's a different version of him if he's surrounded by the right pieces, where he's more like Rajon Rondo from outer space, basically, where he can just get wherever he wants to get on the court, and everybody's getting open looks. And the problem is the Wizards just haven't had guys who can knock them down.
Yeah, I was excited when Whitman decided, hey, we're going to go up tempo. We're going to try to, like, make this jump into the modern approach.
Yeah,
because I'm like always
spread,
a big favor
roll.
Of, like, yeah, I'm always in favor of, like, building around your main player's best attribute. And for me, like, you know, he should be in a D'Antoni type system, right? Where it's just, like, completely, you know, unfiltered, you know, unadulterated, just speed, power,
right,
off the dribble constantly. And I think it's probably an issue of the surrounding personnel not being able to keep up, or, you know, just kind of a continuing, you know, change in direction and vision, where it seems like the last couple of years it's always been a new idea every single year.
Yeah.
And, you know, I kind of wonder, like, how do you feel about Brooks at this point? Because it doesn't really seem like he's putting much of an imprint on these guys. I mean, there was moments where they quit on defense against the Raptors. I mean, the second half, it was ugly. I mean, it was bad, and we're a week into the season.
Well, yeah, and they almost came back in the second half. Wall had, I think, 32, 11, and 5. Like, he was everywhere. He did have 9 turnovers, but, like, he was doing everything, and they just... The Brooks thing, I'm really trying to keep an open mind, but there have been a couple games where, like, the offense doesn't seem to have graduated beyond, like, Beal and Wall taking turns, which is what it was with KD and Russ, which a lot of that was just the way those two guys work and the way the personnel that they had in Oklahoma City. But it definitely is kind of a red flag that they haven't figured out much of a rhythm on offense.
Well, the difference is that KD and Russ would take turns doing amazing things, and these guys are taking turns.
Bradley Beal is not Kevin Durant, and Otto Porter is not Serge Ibaka. Yeah, so we'll see. I don't know. I also, it's only been a week, so I don't want to freak out. I want to give him time to sort of get his bearings a little bit. Scott Brooks, I mean. But it was interesting sitting with Wall. what I was thinking about was basically how if you're a superstar and it works out and the team succeeds every year and like continues to progress, like you will get 98% of the credit. And I think you've seen that with guys all over the league. Like Damian Lillard is a god in Portland, basically, for making the second round last year. But I really think that the flip side of the superstar bargain is that you are putting your faith in the organization to do right by you. And some guys just get screwed, whether it's Anthony Davis, DeMarcus Cousins, John Wall. Maybe it's a Kentucky curse. But you look around the league and it's tough, man.
I was going to say, like, Calipari needs to come through and make a few phone calls and save all of his former A-listers.
For real.
They're all stuck in different places. Yeah, no, I mean, I feel bad for all of them. But at some point when there's this level of kind of continued mediocrity,
yeah,
it goes bigger than a superstar. And if you're not a top five player, I mean, there aren't very many players,
that's what
even
I'm saying.
A Paul George in Indiana. How many guys can really pull a team out of that kind of a slumber? I would say LeBron, KD, Westbrook looks like he's not going to be part of that group. I'd put Chris Paul in that group, considering what he did turning around the Clippers.
Yeah.
And I would put Steph in that category too. So I'd say there's maybe five guys right now who could really, and actually Kawhi Leonard, you know, he always gets overlooked, but we should throw him in this mix as well.
Yeah.
So that's six guys who can take a team that, you know, may or may not be great on paper and make it respectable, right? And that's not saying, you know, it just means that Wall is not an A-lister. You know, he's a A-minus or a B-plus.
That's all-star. My thing is, just because he's not in that elite group of like six guys does not mean that he is not awesome. Honestly, I think if I had to pick a comparison, I would say he's a little bit like Paul Pierce in Boston, who was very good but not good enough to really like carry them during some of those down years. And he had Antoine Walker and they made some runs, and but then when he didn't get the help, like he was in a spot where I think he wanted to look elsewhere. The Celtics weren't sure what they were gonna do, and obviously like the organization figured it out and everything worked out. But I think that's where Wall is right now.
There's another one in Melo, you know, it'd be another comparable point there. Hey, let's just cut to the chase, though. Like, where are you going to trade Bradley Beal?
Well, so that's the thing. There have been some articles. The Ringer ran something about trading Wall. I really wouldn't trade Wall because I don't think you're going to get anywhere close to fair value. And I think the better approach is to treat him like Pierce and be like, look, we are going to go all out to get you some help, whether it's Boogie or whoever else. Beal, I would be calling the Sacramento Kings every single day to try and get Cousins for Beal. Like,
you're not getting Cousins for Beal.
If though. I were running the Wizards, the Kings would have to take out a restraining order on me because it would be just constant, hourly. Like, let's make a deal. Do you want Otto Porter? Do you want Markieff Morris? Gortat? Like, we'd take our entire roster. Take the Washington Caps. Like, we'll give you whatever you need.
The first step in dealing with Vlade is just to try to convince Beal to change his last name to like Bogdanovich, like Bradley Bogdanovich, because that'll immediately like double his value in Vlade's eyes.
I mean, look, the Kings do have four centers, so, and Scal is good, and I don't know, man. But beyond that, I like a semi-serious point is that I think Otto Porter is going to be more useful long-term than Beal because of what he can do defensively. And he's going to need to get paid this summer. So I don't think you definitely can't lock yourself into like $300 million worth of Wall, Beal, and Otto Porter. So if of those three, I would definitely look to be moving Beal.
That is really a depressing thought to be looking forward to that already. But that's what happens when you start 0-3 or 0-4, whatever it is.
All right. Well, good depressing note to end the pod on. I will talk to you Monday afternoon for next week's pod with some, we'll talk some league pass notes. But until then, I think we're good.
All right, man. Take care.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.